This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The 2019 edition of the UN's Human Development Report was launched back on the 9th of December 2019 and is said to articulate a rise of a new generation of inequalities. So the report analyzed inequality in three steps, which are beyond income, beyond averages, and beyond today. And highlighting that the problem of inequality is not beyond solutions, the publication proposes ways of tackling these inequalities so that the 22nd century will be one where every person has equal opportunities and freedoms. And joining me now to shed more light on this report is Niloy Banerjee, who is the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore, and Brunei Darussalam. Welcome, Niloy. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you, Juliet. Lovely to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So, you know, for those of us who are unfamiliar with this report, I mean, what does the Human Development Report focus on and analyze?
Traditionally, the Human Development Report came about as a way to look at human well-being beyond what is the traditional economist's way of at looking at well-being, which is GDP per capita, mm-hmm. meaning national income per capita per human being. And in the 90s, the UNDP ecosystem sort of got together and said, we need more comprehensive measures. It's not just how much you earn. Mm. The easiest way to understand that is income is relative. Right. What your money buys in a certain setting, even within Malaysia, the cost of living is different in different cities. Mm-hmm. So it's really measures of well-being have to be beyond income. Mm-hmm. And that's how some major scholars like Professor Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate,
that's right.
The late Professor Mahbub ul Haq, the Pakistani economist, they got together and came to create, they provided the intellectual energy and drive behind creating a measure of human development, which started off, it still kept the measure of poverty, mm-hmm. Which includes the measure of income per capita, but it also included health and education and educational attainment, education expectations of years of education, etc., and built a more composite measure mm-hmm. of human development. And over the years, UNDP has now been doing this since 1990. So this is almost our 30th birthday.
Wow, that's
with the
amazing.
Human Development Report.
And I mean, how are these findings actually measured? I mean, I imagine it must be a global effort to get all of these sorts of data and to quantify it and to make it qualitative.
Correct. So that's why you see the 300-page report. There's a lot.
366.
First, a lot of numbers go in.
Sure.
And then there's huge amounts of analysis and narrative explaining those numbers. Mm. And then it's illustrated by case studies. So, yes, it's a global effort. UNDP's Human Development Report team actually trawls through multiple data sets to get all this data from different sources. Mm-hmm. And of course, then there's a process of verification and validating, and then putting a narrative around this. What is the data saying? What is it speaking to us about?
That's right. And, you know, I mean, I'm curious to know, do you think that the debate about inequality, that that's often oversimplified?
Yes, this is inequality has been one of the more stubborn measures of inequality, which is the economist's measure called Gini coefficient.
Yes.
And it has remained in vogue for the last 30 years, just as wealth and well-being have been measured as per capita income. Mm-hmm. These two concepts have remained very, very stubborn in economics. There have been multiple attempts to sort of finesse these, make them more sophisticated, that as a society evolves and grows, it needs more sophisticated measures of poverty. Mm-hmm. I would argue that just economic growth is not the only measure of prosperity in a country, for
That's
example,
right.
Well, whether you've protected your forests, your biodiversity, your the animals in the forests for future generations as well. These measures also need to come in and inform what prosperity or development means. It's not just growing economically.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's been this stubbornness of income-based measures of poverty have kind of tended to oversimplify and the debate on inequality, because we are still measuring countries and ranking them
based on
these measures, very linear economic measures of poverty. So that's why we say it's beyond income in our tagline for this report.
That's right. You're an economist yourself, am I correct?
I am.
So, I mean, this must be also quite a shift for you as well in this role.
It's a welcome shift. yes, it is. It's fun. It's, just getting to debate issues and ideas with colleagues like you, but also with your audience and talk about these things. And the government of Malaysia as well, who's been very receptive to these ideas, to say, let's rethink how we measure poverty in Malaysia.
And that's the crux of it, isn't it? We have to rethink so many things. There's so much mindset changing that we need to talk about. Well, we'll talk about that later. So I understand that the publication, that the report, the HDR 2019 report, it finds that 20% of human development progress was lost through inequalities in 2018. What does that mean exactly?
If you take the sum total of how much better we could have done globally, as a society, as humankind, but also for our ecosystem, and by ecosystem, I just don't mean the environmental ecosystem, but a more general social, environmental, people, planet ecosystem.
Sure.
If inequalities were not so persistent and if they were mitigated better, we would have an overall well-being of the general population of humankind, which would be of a higher grade. And by that, I mean, it's still, we are leaving behind, even as we become prosperous and well-to-do societies, we are leaving behind vast swathes of populations, groups, youth, countries which are facing conflict and other kinds of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Within countries, we are leaving behind vast swathes of populations. Indigenous people tend to be one.
Mm-hmm.
Within the gender construct, women are still quite far behind. It's improving, but it's global averages show that in the developing world, women are still quite significantly behind. So that's it. Because of inequalities, our sum total of our progress is getting dragged back.
That's right. Okay.
So that's the message of this report, if you like.
Okay. And I mean, let's talk about what the report outlines. So it said that a new generation of inequalities is opening up around education, but also around technology and climate change. So maybe you could help elaborate on that.
Correct. Juliet, what we are seeing worldwide is, of course, the rise of a digital economy and internet-based knowledge economy.
Mm-hmm.
If so, we are talking about very different sorts of capabilities that people will need to thrive and perform in these economies.
Mm-hmm.
If you just for a minute think back in your own personal situations, how much more difficult it is for our parents to be using touch phones than our children to be using touch phones. It's just a brain wiring thing. It's an intuitive, because the youngsters are so much more used to these machines already, right from a very young age.
Yeah.
Their brains get wired differently, and they, of course, have better intuition about how to use technology.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the exact opposite with the elderly. They're falling more and more behind, struggling to deal with these new gadgets. I see it in my house for sure. My father and the touch phone is quite a challenge. So, the digital world is going to create new inequalities for sure. We've seen that in the past, even with the current internet penetration and internet-based economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
You see that there is a rural-urban divide. Urban areas are doing much better in using technology, making good with technology, be it social good or financial good,
mm-hmm.
whereas rural areas are falling behind. A lot of digital economy revenues are being generated in the urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
So this was our previous generation of sort of already differentiated inequalities brought about by technology.
Right.
And now, for to be ready for technology, you also need a certain base of education.
Correct.
And that, again, is almost conditioned by the lottery of birth.
Mm-hmm.
From day one, you could get conditioned to be very tech-savvy, very articulate with a wide vocabulary, a large familiarity with a larger set of languages, a larger set of words, likewise with mathematical and numerical skills, etc. And that is that starts way before you even hit the first day of school.
That's true.
It starts with conditioning at home. It starts with the learning environment that you have. And then it continues lifelong. So there's a real danger that those who don't have optimal learning environments are going to be put at a disadvantage right from day
one. Right
from
birth, right?
So that's the technological. The third is the climate change related issue.
Mm-hmm.
And let me illustrate that very, very concretely. If climate change impacts food production, as is widely agreed in the scientific community, prices of food will rise.
Mm-hmm.
Prices of food will also rise driven by other factors such as the population of the world is growing. So there's more people eating food and there's food production has kept up, but it's falling behind.
Mm-hmm.
So Malaysia, for example, is importing 50 billion ringgit worth of food every year.
That's crazy. 50 billion.
Yeah, and there's no easy fix to re-engineer that by starting to grow more food in Malaysia, because then, I mean, there's a land limitation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there is a limitation of how much more farmland can you acquire at cost of what? Forests,
mm-hmm.
mangroves,
mm-hmm.
Peatlands. So, you know, it's all becoming quite zero sum. So anyway, if food prices do rise, the third factor where food prices will rise is as the global population becomes more wealthy, the composition of diets will change.
Okay.
And particularly more meat, animal protein-based
diets, right?
Will put bigger pressures on agriculture and food systems, because it takes about, I forget the exact ratio, but about 20 kilos of grain to produce 1 kilo of meat, beef. So there you are. 20 kilos of grain would have fed, I don't know, 20 people for 3 days, but 1 kilo of meat will not. So the conversion rate is not very efficient.
Yeah.
So food prices will rise.
Mm-hmm.
If food prices rise, the poor, as you know, their income is largely spent on food or housing.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the wealthy, who probably spend 5% of their income on food and housing.
Right.
If food prices do rise, the overall income savings mix of the poor gets very adversely impacted. Or even middle class folks like us will face, I mean, if you save up X amount for your retirement pension,
mm-hmm.
and meanwhile, by the time you retire, food prices have gone up 3 times, your pension will not go quite as far as you had planned in your productive years when you were saving for your pension. So it's just something to be, the impact of climate change will put nutritional inequalities in place,
mm-hmm.
because the poor may have to compensate by eating more basic, therefore non-nutritious foods.
Mm-hmm.
It could also just put many kinds of foods out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, whether it's a slow onset disaster or an immediate natural calamity, the poor always get hit worse.
That's
so
true.
A slow onset disaster like food prices rising thanks to climate change,
mm-hmm.
will definitely impact. The rich will, I mean, when the haze happens, the rich can go into filtered air-conditioned rooms.
They can afford those expensive air filters.
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's the impact on poor is always disproportionate.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking today to Niloy Banerjee. He's the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. And we're discussing the Human Development Report 2019, which was just launched back in December of last year. So we're going to talk a bit more about how the report analyzes inequalities in different steps beyond income, beyond averages and beyond today after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Niloy Banerjee. He is the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. And we're discussing the Human Development Report 2019, which is said to have articulated a rise of a new generation of inequalities. So, Niloy, we were discussing some of those new inequalities. But let's focus a little bit on Malaysia in particular. I mean, what do you think are some of the challenges that we're facing as we head into the next decade?
Okay. First, the good news.
Okay.
Malaysia is ranked... the Human Development Index is constructed in bands. Mm-hmm. So Malaysia is ranked in the very high Human Development band, which is a group of about 65 countries, mm-hmm. Along with Brunei and Singapore. So these are the only three countries in the region who are in that category. That means Malaysia is doing something right.
Okay. Yes.
So if you take the basic business of managing inequalities, Malaysia has made tremendous progress. Health, life expectancy, infant mortality, the number of years of education you can expect to have reasonably on the day you were born, it's up to about 10 now. So any Malaysian today should expect to get at least 10 years of education. Mm-hmm. So these are great achievements compared to, let's say, in countries where this unfinished business is still quite unfinished. Right. South Asia being only 42% of South Asian adults have a primary education. Mm. And then, of course, in the income category, of course, Malaysia has done quite well. So that's the good news. The challenges. Malaysia's gender disparity mm-hmm. is quite stark, outstandingly stark, even in the region.
Really?
Yes. If you deconstruct the Malaysian human development rank, mm-hmm. it's in by gender.
Okay.
Women and men are at par in the educational parameters.
Okay, yep.
In fact, as you know, Malaysian women are doing better at education, graduating more tertiary education, more prepared for jobs, but then they're not staying in the job market mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for various reasons we can go into. Life expectancy, which is the other big parameter in the Human Development Index, women are actually marginally above men.
Okay.
So where's the difference? The difference is in incomes, which is the third big parameter of the Human Development Index. Malaysian men, on average, are earning $30,000 to $31,000 in purchasing power parity terms. So forgive that economist jargon, but the average income of the Malaysian male, and this is an average, therefore there is a fallacy here. Not all Malaysian males are making that.
Sure.
Is $31,000 to $32,000 per year.
Okay.
The average income of the Malaysian female is $20,000.
Wow.
That's if you were a sociologist, anthropologist, economist, policymaker, that's an unacceptable difference mm-hmm. because Malaysian women, remember, are going to college yeah. much more than men.
Yeah.
So here's a very productive, powerful agency of economic development that may be using their time for social, cultural, family reasons in a suboptimal way.
Right.
And that is, so if you actually then rank Malaysia as two different countries, the men of Malaysia and the women of Malaysia, mm-hmm. the men of Malaysia are still in the high human development category. Mm. The women of Malaysia are, the men are in the very high. The women are actually only in the high, which is the next band of countries.
Next band, right.
So it's only that the average of women and men is taking it above the threshold.
Right.
So that is, as a policymaker, that should be almost one of your top priorities if you're one today.
Mm-hmm. There's also something else about, I think, the poverty that in Malaysia. I mean, we can see how wealthy and how, you know, how well we are doing. But we are also, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the people who are being left behind, the indigenous communities, the people in the B40 category. Is that something that's also, you know, a matter of concern for our policymakers?
Yes, that should be a matter of concern for not just Malaysia. It's a global matter of concern that we are leaving pockets of populations behind. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the UN Sustainable Development Goals. The entire normative value framework of those goals is that leave no one behind. Mm-hmm. We have to, because as soon as you create these divisions of leaving whole swathes of the population behind, you're creating room for A, social strife. But B, you're also creating very different levels of expectations, trust, etc., between government and society.
Mm-hmm.
If you think the government has given you an enabling environment in which you can thrive, you have a very different love and fresh air feeling towards the government versus if you feel that the government has given, the ecosystem that the government has created has given you no opportunities, has thrown you far behind everybody else, then you have a different kind of resentment about the ecosystem, about society. So, yes, pockets of poverty and all kinds of pockets, differences in groups. You mentioned some indigenous communities, the B40. The elderly will be soon a vulnerable pocket as well for reasons I just went into in the other illustration.
Yeah.
That calculations of pension and well-being beyond productive years are in serious danger of being upended because of inflation, food price, rise in prices of basic commodities.
That's right.
So what you had thought would be good enough for a pension kitty is not good enough anymore.
Right. And also if you're losing behind in the technological areas as well, I mean, like, you're less likely to be reemployed if you need to work at a...
That's great.
When you're, you know, in your...
That's great.
In your
and
culture.
Unless conscious policy is designed
to
bring the elderly into the workforce.
That's right.
They're still productive, you know,
because of
good education, good health conditions. But these have to be, policy has to be designed consciously. It just won't happen by itself.
Mm-hmm.
The market will auto-correct somehow? No way.
No.
So, and the third is, again, women. If as a highly educated lady, you have to drop out of the workforce for 10, 12 years, you've missed out, A, on pension contributions for those years.
Yeah.
Because in the, you know, even if you work as a consultant at home, even if you work as a consultant at home, you're not really in the pension, the formal pension social security system.
Exactly.
So you're missing out. Again, another inequality, i.e. elderly women will probably have less savings than elderly men, which is, again, retirement savings, which is a problem. Again, you see, we are creating many kinds of horizontal and vertical inequalities, which, yes, Malaysia and other countries have to consciously design for and counteract.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's something you said, right? That we need to design policies that correct these factors and that we need to look beyond economic growth as the only definition, am I correct?
Correct.
Of development.
Correct.
Okay, all right. And so how do we, I mean, it seems like endless problems or it seems like problems that cannot be solved. But is that just a matter of changing mindset? I mean, as the report says, it's about looking beyond the income, beyond the averages, beyond today, especially.
Correct.
Right. So, I mean, talk me through those three things. Let's start with beyond income. So, as you mentioned earlier, if inequality begins even before birth, I mean, how can we actually even start to counter that?
We have to do what are called pre-market policies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, even before a human being enters into productive employment, we have to make sure that educational opportunities provide a level playing field as far as practicable.
Okay.
And that means affordability of quality education. Quality education is kind of also one of the benchmarks that we have to bear in mind.
Sure.
Second, even things like access to education. I'm relatively new to Malaysia and I'm still learning these facts. But apparently there are pockets where kids have to walk 5 kilometers to go to school and wade through a little stream or a river. And I've seen some video footage of this. So there is access, quality, affordability. So these pre-market priming of the workforce have to be done.
Okay.
Then there are some market, in-market conditions. And here we have to look at things like the growth of large monopolies, which, you know, there's a concentration of wealth at the top. I mean, and we know that globally. I mean, the top 10 richest persons control, 67% of the world's wealth. That's
talking about inequality.
So we need to really, 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 in each individual national policy regime, such as Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, we have to very consciously design for non-monopolized garnering of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Wealth has to be more distributed. And I'll come to that part in the next bit. Another in-market policy is the allowance of collective bargaining.
Okay.
Back in the day, trade unions used to do that. But now trade unions, as an individual, as a professional, I support the idea of unions. But as an individual, I sometimes worry about unions. You're flying an airline, you've bought a ticket, suddenly the whole airline staff have gone on strike, you're extremely... So there's a little bit of social wariness about unions. But there's other ways to do collective bargaining as groups.
Mm-hmm.
Advocacy. That's what women's groups, for example, are doing by working on issues like gender-based violence, domestic gender-based violence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also a form of collective bargaining.
Right.
So that's an in-market policy. We have to do more antitrust laws. We have to do more, allow more collective bargaining by groups that are falling behind or on the lower end of the inequality scale. And then what you would call a the post-market policies, which is really taxation and social protection.
Uh-huh.
Once wealth or incomes have been garnered from the market, the best way to redistribute it is still the old-fashioned taxation.
Mm.
There's no better redistributive instrument. And also state-sponsored or public-private-sponsored insurance schemes, pension schemes, social security schemes. So we can do that. But again, conscious policy design has to move in that direction. The digital economy offers great opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, ladies who cannot be, who have dropped out of the workforce because of childcare reasons or elderly care reasons, can use the digital economy to do home-based work.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Mm-hmm.
There can be consultancy gigs from home. There can be occasional gigs because of connecting algorithms. You can probably go to an app and say who needs an MC or a radio jockey for 2 days in a week.
That's
and
right.
So again, workplace policies have to be more flexible to accommodate these.
Mm-hmm.
That's again going back to the policy regime.
Mm-hmm.
You could incentivize e-commerce, home-based e-commerce, buying and selling of online products.
That's right.
You have to regulate these, you have to incentivize these, and you have to make sure that people who engage in these kinds of gig economy work or home-based economy or telecommuting or e-commerce are also in the larger social protection schemes of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a home-based worker, you're not in any pension scheme.
That's right.
So who's looking after your future? So.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I cannot stress enough the need to design pro-people policies and consciously.
I think the key word here is consciously doing
that.
But okay, so let's tackle beyond averages now. So the publication says that averages often hide what is really going on in society. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. The example that I gave you of women in Malaysia and the gender disaggregated human development index.
Mm.
Is clear. Women are earning less, the Malaysian average is looking pretty good.
But
if you disaggregate it by just this one parameter, gender, you see, there is a gap here between women and men.
And then if you put in poverty, you could
exactly.
change
again. You could do that for indigenous communities. You say indigenous and non-indigenous. If you divide it by that, you'll see the differences.
Right.
But the averages, of course, mask that fact.
That's right.
Because so if my neighbor is a billionaire and I'm earning 1,000 ringgit a day, the average for my community will be still pretty good.
Exactly.
But that doesn't hide the fact that somebody is a billionaire and somebody is barely getting by.
Yeah.
So that's the beyond averages that we have to go beyond these.
And how do we even tackle that? Again, conscious policies?
Policy, but also metrics. Eh? We have to get our economists and social scientists need to design better measures, better ways to measure.
Mm.
And one of the things that's now with better data is coming to light, which is quite startling, is that in families with a larger number of children, there is intra-household inequality.
Oh my gosh.
One child is undernourished, whereas the other three or four or six may not be undernourished.
Wow.
And that's, the report talks a little bit about that. And so, for example, Malaysia has, on average, more incidence of stunting among children than countries at a comparable income grade.
Oh.
I don't have the exact figure for you, but now that's alarming.
That is a very
That means
alarming.
There's a nutrition problem primarily, but there may be other sort of, living conditions, etc. problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we need better metrics. There was no way to measure intra-household, within a household inequalities. In South Asia, it's quite well known that women are severely undernourished relative to men.
Mm-hmm.
The boy child gets to eat before the girl child in many poor households. The current measures of inequality need to be finessed immensely. And so this report actually has quite a few additional measures like the gender development index. Mm-hmm. But it also proposes, and this is something that UNDP is currently dialoguing with the government of Malaysia, what is called a multidimensional poverty index, which is a way to measure poverty with far more numbers of parameters.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the parameters that multidimensional poverty measures is how many adults living in one room, a confined room.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it's a question of optimality. You could say, if you just checked scientifically, you would say, you have a roof over your head. But maybe that room is being shared by six people, six adults. That's suboptimal.
That's right.
So hence a more refined measure here.
Nuanced, right?
Yes. So better measures, conscious policy, and that more intractable, slightly tenuous issue of mindsets.
Mm. Okay. And I mean, it's very promising to hear that you are in dialogue with the Malaysian government and that they're open to such dialogues. Because I think when the report came out about poverty in Malaysia, that was not really welcomed very well. So it's nice to hear that there's some discussion about that. How about beyond today? I mean, we know that protests are happening even now about things that matter, you know, way beyond today already. Are we doing enough?
I would say we are at the cement has been poured.
Mm-hmm.
It's about to harden very quickly. We are at that moment in time.
Okay.
We can do enough. But we are, and we have to quickly take cognizance of what's happening and prepare for it. So in the digital economy with IR 4.0, artificial intelligence, automation, we will see a shift in work patterns, in jobs, the kinds of jobs that are available. In my lifetime, I've seen, for example, banks. The largest land area when you walked into a bank was occupied by tellers who gave out cash, who who cashed your checks for you, who received your deposit in cash. They sat in little cubicles and you communicated with them through a glass or an iron grill. Those jobs have disappeared with the coming of ATM machines.
That's right.
The banking industry has generated other kinds of jobs, but those particular jobs don't exist anymore, mm-hmm. and they never came back. So you can see, I'm drawing a very simple story to tell you that automation will cost jobs.
Yeah.
And the Malaysian government knows it. EPF is doing quite a bit of research on it. As a global megatrend, almost one in two jobs will disappear because of automation, current sets of jobs. So which means we have to retool and quickly find ways where new areas where new jobs will create themselves.
Right.
If so, then education systems need to gear up for that.
Yeah.
Science and technology education have to receive a far bigger boost than they are currently receiving. I would say all over Asia, but some countries are doing obviously better than preparing for that future.
Mm-hmm.
Digital broadband coverage in developed countries, it's growing at 15 times the rate of what it is growing in developing countries. Again, within countries, some are running away, mm-hmm. like racehorses, and some are sort of plodding along. And these are the inequalities of the future for which this time we are on the edge of the precipice. So we can pull back, conscious policy. But conscientious policy too. The report argues that certainly in another decade or so, these will become entrenched inequalities. So the time is now. Really, to act.
Okay. And, you know, we do want to reach the Sustainable Development Goals. We're just in 2020 now.
Correct.
We've got 10 years and there's a
Correct.
Lot of work to be done. I mean, I'm afraid we are running out of time as well, but what would your take-home message be for people who are listening?
I think we've talked a lot about preparing the country for the future. I have the Future Ready Malaysia.
Mm.
I have two more appeals to Malaysians. One is begin to think of development as more than economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
You are now rapidly approaching a developed country status. And the narrative in a developed country should be things like environmental protection is also economic growth, because you've protected an asset and therefore that asset is valued and has an economic value, a money value, really.
Mm.
So, reframe development away from simply economic growth.
I think what the environmentalists say is you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Or as our Secretary General said, there's no planet B.
That's
so
true.
Don't count on a plan B here.
Yeah. Forget those trips to Mars, yeah?
The second one I would say is pay attention to social cohesion. First and foremost, I know most people tend to talk about the ethnic composition of Malaysia. That is valid. Pay attention to that, but also pay attention to the infinitely better gender who should be having more economic opportunities but are somehow being constrained.
Mm-hmm.
So by social cohesion, I really mean also getting women, indigenous people, elderly, far more designed into the economic and social mainstream. Currently, they are not. They're a little bit excluded.
Mm-hmm. So that's a conscious and conscientious policy.
Correct.
Things need to be sorted.
Correct.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking today to Niloy Banerjee. He's the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. And we were discussing the Human Development Report of 2019. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available also on Google Play, the App Store and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.